alternative measure of the very thing against which the Baal Shem Tov was rebelling. Again, all within the framework of halakha, and we're not dealing with the partners of halakha, but this notion. And Peshitzchah tried to restore that aspect of it. But at the same time, in Peshitzchah, we will see there was a tragedy with the Baal Shem Tov and a tremendous gift in the ability of the masses to that connection. In Peshitzchahism that bordered on pessimism and disillusioned that they were losing something, and they were not quite sure whether they were capable of praying. It's a very, very introspective school of great irony, and a school which sometimes stresses the fact that maybe certain things that we thought could be done, all its approach was one of honesty. There were other Hasidic courts in which life went on as usual, pomp and circumstance. Peshitzchah did not allow any type of pretense, as you would expect. When you strip away all defenses, one is sometimes confronted with a core that is very frightening to confront. Just the extreme case was the Kutzker Rebbe, essentially, we'll discuss what it was exactly, we'll discuss that in some detail, but the Kutzker Rebbe was merely the most visible expression of something very deep and painful that was brewing under the surface. That's why Peshitzchah was a Hasidic school, which made many of the Hasidic leaders in Poland very afraid, because they thought, in effect, that this would just destroy the whole foundation. In essence, if I could borrow an analogy from another religion, if you remember, in Crime and Punishment, the Brothers Karamazov, the Brothers Karamazov, Dostoevsky's novel, there was a book in the book about the Grand Inquisitor. If you remember, the Grand Inquisitor was in charge of burning people at the stake who were heretics. And Dostoevsky was an anti-Catholic, because he was actually an advocate for Greek Orthodox religion as it was practiced in Russia. So in his little novella within the Brothers Karamazov, Jesus comes back to earth. And Jesus starts preaching charity and loving kindness and money to the poor, etc. And the Inquisitor thinks this is revolutionary, because this is going to take away the financial support that the church needs for its cathedrals and all of its wealth. So he calls Jesus in and says, you know, I'm going to have to burn you at the stake. You are hurting the institution. And Dostoevsky's satire was that the Grand Inquisitor knew very well who he was talking about. You know, I know that you're a son of God and everything else, but still, we have an institution that we have to preserve, and we can't do it anyway. Now again, please forgive me. I should ask the people from the great tzaddikim that we're talking about tonight for bringing in such an irreverent analogy. But the analogy holds very, very true. I mean, I'm not a Dostoevsky, so I can't put it in that literary form. But we will see that Peshitzchah was very, very feared to the individualistic foundation, an institution, the establishment. And therefore, actually put the school of Peshitzchah on trial. They were acquitted, it was kind of a mini inquisition, literally, regarding whether we should allow the activities of Peshitzchah to keep on going. Now, that's why it's a very, very fascinating school. Now, it's interesting, if you read Buber, Buber seems to have thought that Peshitzchah was the last flame of that authentic attempt to recapture Hasidut before it really died down and simply became, that much I think many could argue with, many could dispute, because after all, if you look at it in terms of sheer numbers, Peshitzchah eventually flowered into Ger and some other movements, which was the largest Hasidut. So at least quantitatively, there certainly was a tremendous success in terms of Torah institutions, etc. Nevertheless, on the deeper issue of whether they succeeded in recapturing the inner spirits, that is a question in which there continued to be debate. It's very true that if you meet, like any group of people, not every Hasid that you will meet is an inspired person who is totally connected to God. There are those who are Hasidim because that's how they were raised. There are, on the other hand, individuals who are inspired and who are godly. And like every movement, there are those who live the ideals and those who do not. And again, one can argue, those who are more critical of the movement say that Hasidut today is primarily an institutionalized phenomenon. And those who will say that it's probably different from Chabad. Peshitzchah does not have a developed theology. That's one thing. In fact, one of the unique features about Chabad is it's virtually the only movement, with the exception of Breslov, which I'll get to. Breslov is a totally separate phenomenon, which I'll get to later. They de-emphasize, first of all, Kabbalistic literature. Chabad is very heavy into have a list of literature, but they are very astute psychologists of the soul, and they tend to teach with aphorism and parable. They're art and pungent and to the point, but there is not a developed theology. In fact, there was a certain impatience for theorizing, because as little Yudhis Chabad as its name, Chachma Binan Dat, was very, very concerned with a theoretical process utilizing Kabbalistic and rationalistic. The Shishka, I find myself, is very, very fascinating because it raises issues that cut across even religion. What happens to the 60s flower chicken? Forgive this, I love analogy. The 60s flower chicken, when they become CEOs, right? The issue of how do you retain idealism when you become the mainstream? And this was the tragic dilemma. Now, in Vashishka's case, it's a much more tragic than, because we're not dealing with trivial issues, we're dealing with the relationship to God, we're dealing with ultimate concerns. So it's not, you know, just, you know, the situation of a 60s rebel who now feels his life is boring, etc. These were major, major, major issues. And this began, really, with the breakaway of the holy Jew, the Yehudi HaKadosh, from the Chazev Lublin. Remember, the Chazev Lublin was involved with the masses, trying to elevate them. The Yehudi HaKadosh kind of broke off to deal with the elite and teach them. Needed ceremony. The masses needed pageantry. The masses needed a central figure that they could go to. So Peshischa was a school which involved certain elements of disillusionments and also certain elements of elitism. Recognized that people might need certain things. But we find that in Peshischa, eventually, although here later got the numbers, but initially it was very, very elitist. And of course, elitism starts off with a desire to serve God unencumbered by social convention. And what we see when we look through the leaders of all Peshischa, Rav Simcha Bunin, the Kutzky Rebbe, and some of the other leaders which we'll look at briefly tonight, honestly, is a disillusionment, it's an expression of hope for to get the selected few, but then kind of a tragic recognition. So I think fundamentally and theologically, one we still have to go through today, spiritual revival by definition will eventually, if it's successful, will eventually become the very thing that it tried to replace. That was a famous in political theory on revolutions. Marx is a notable exception, although some would say not, that in virtually all revolutions, those who have overthrown the established order become guilty of the same animal farm. The French Revolution, right? Robespierre was no more benign than Louis XV. The Russian Revolution, right? Revolution, you become what you overthrow. And this was the painful awareness of the Shishka. It's a very, very fascinating. Well, the founder of the Shishka was Hayudi HaKadosh, the Holy Yid, as it were. Remember, we discussed last week that the Holy Yid split away from his teacher, the Chozev Lublin, and that was a source of great resentment and pain throughout their lives, etc. But the Holy Yid's primary disciple, who was really the founder of the school of Peshischa per se, is Rav Simcha Bunin. The dates of his life, 1765 to 1827. Rav Simcha Bunin had an interesting history. He was called the cosmopolitan Rebbe. He had studied to a lot of different rabbis, but eventually he gravitated to the Yehudi HaKadosh, the Holy Jew. For a while he had been with the Magid of Kuznets, but then he went to the Chazev, but then he found himself as one of the elites who gravitated to the Yehudi HaKadosh. In his youth, he had a lot of jobs. He was not a cloistered individual. He worked in industry. He traveled widely. He visited major trade fairs in Danzig in Germany and Leipzig. And he wore what were called European-style clothes, meaning unlike the Polish Jew who dressed in long black garments, he wore the short suits that the successful businessmen were wearing. He spoke Polish and German. He visited the theater occasionally, and he enjoyed playing cards and chess. So he was quite cosmopolitan. He was a timber merchant. Later, he became a pharmacist. He didn't have to go to school for that. He became a pharmacist. He used to prepare medicine, etc. In fact, one of the accusations in his mini trial, we will see, was that when he was a pharmacist, he used to talk to the women who would come in and ask for drugs. Talk to the women, that's something that was already in Hasidic Poland, but that was already a severe accusation. etc. Anyway, he fell under the spell of the Yehudi HaKadosh. He became his successor, and ultimately he was chosen to be his. Some of the more established Hasidic groups would sneer at it. They would say, how did he qualify to become a Hasidic Rebbe? Did he qualify by playing cards in Danzig? Did he qualify by speaking to the women who came to his pharmacy? They thought that he did not fit the particular situation. But his retort was that many Hasidic Rebbe, he actually said it in a very nice way, many Hasidic Rebbe's have never experienced sin, and therefore they don't know how to recognize it, and they don't know how to deal with it. But he is well aware of the evils to which human beings are prone, and therefore he is a capable doctor to enable people to deal with the various ills that inspire people with the fear of God. What is interesting about Rav Simcha Bunim is he really was the first Hasidic leader who had a remarkable impact on the youth. And hundreds and thousands of youth would flock to him. He inspired them. He elevated them. He gave them a feeling that they were capable, right? Among some when you're 50 and then we'll let them. He was the opposite. He dealt with the youth. He inspired them. He made them recognize their greatness. A person might say this had some of the characteristics of a cult, although it was not that at all. And sometimes people left their wives for extended periods of time to be with them. And in fact, he was often attacked. That was one of the ideas. He was breaking up families, etc. Nevertheless, this is what happened. I know it's over here. Interesting, there was a wedding, I think in the 1820s, there was a massive Hasidic wedding in Ostila. Ostila was a town in Poland. And like all of the Rebbes of Poland came to this wedding. Again, for some reason irreverent analogies come to mind tonight. In the 1950s, when the government was first investigating the mafia, in Appalachia, New York, that town of New York, like there was a mafia wedding where every single crime head of the United States were there. And the FBI was there taking pictures. Well, this was very similar. This was a wedding in which every Hasidic Rebbe in Poland was there. And Rav Simcha Bunim was put, he was not there, but he was put on trial in absentia. Whether he ought to be deposed or ought to be condemned, or actually, it's not clear what authority he would have exactly, but whether he ought to be censured because, number one, because he's breaking up families, number two, because of his background, number three, primarily because of the teachings we discussed later, where he was undermining the established institutional structure. And some of his disciples very ably defended him. There were five disciples that spoke in his behalf. And the senior Hasidic Rebbe of Poland, who was the Apter Rav, the Rav of Apt, the famous Hasidic leader, exonerated him and said, he's fine, leave him alone. He has his own ways, and don't trouble them.
Who said that? Which one?
This is the Rav of Apt. Yeah. The name is Rav Abraham Joshua Heschel's namesake. Avraham Yahushua Heschel was the Rav of Apt, who was called the Moses of his generation. He was a very senior, he was 100 years old, and he was the one that was a judge who adjudicated that Rav Simcha Bunim was kosher. But let me give you a parable, one of Rav Simcha Bunim's parables. And you can see why some of the Hasidic Rebbes might have thought he's a little dangerous. One thing that he said was, having a fur hat and an illustrious father do not make you a tzaddik. No doubt, he says, when Esav would celebrate the Shabbat, he also wore a shtreimel and said a Dvar Torah in Suda Shlishit. So he's making the point that how you dress and what your family lineage is do not determine what you are inside, because Esav had a good father, Jacob, and Esav probably in Kiddush and ate Suda Shlishit. Another point, let me give you another parable, and you can see why this might grate at some of the rabbis of Poland. He gave a mashal about a simple peasant who was wandering around in a drunken stupor. And as he collapsed in the street, his friends thought they would have some fun with him. First of all, even using this type of parable in Poland was a little risque. They dressed him in the garment of a bishop, and they brought him to a palace. And he wakes up after several hours, and he sees himself wearing this bishop's garments, and he says, well, if I'm wearing clothes, I must be a bishop. So he looks at some of the bookshelves, he pulls out a book, and it's a Latin Bible, and he opens it up, and he doesn't understand a word, but he says, wait a second here, how can I be a bishop if I can't read the Bible? So Rav Wunim says, what will he conclude? Instead of concluding, I can't read the Bible, I'm not a bishop, he says, well, it must be other bishops don't know how to read the Bible either. They just pretend. And Rav Wunim says, this is sometimes what happens in spiritual life. People become deluded that they are because of the way they dress a certain way, because of what other people say they are. But he never denigrated other people. That was not his therapy. He was a very, very kind, gentle, ironical man. In fact, he was not overly emotional either. He had a very gentle quality about him. And he was not so much addressing other rabbis. He was just addressing how we have to be honest to ourselves. But it kind of stunned some of the messages. Stunned. And he talks about another famous, very, very famous thing that he says, which I think you've heard before, is he is the source of that famous adage that a human being always has to have two ideas. There is the teaching of the Mishnah, Nivra Ha'olam. Did God create only one human being? God created many animals, but only one human being, so that each human being should recognize that the whole universe came into existence for one person. And therefore the humbleness, submission, will never turn to God, they will never utilize their potential. And you can see this delicate balance that carries across every aspect of education. It's in the need to have humility and modesty in the service of God with an awareness of one's inner greatness. That is, it's magic for a person not to be aware of their flaws. But it's even, the two statements, right? Anokhi Apar Ve'efer is in the Chumash, Bishvili Nivra Olam is in the Mishnah. So, but he said, you got to take both of these and carry them around at the same time. He talked about the truth. He talked about curbing the cult of the tzaddik, as we said. One of the things of Fashiska, which is perhaps a little strange, is he de-emphasized congregational prayer. He was very much an advocate of the idea that one should pray when one is able to turn to God in truth. And until you can turn to God in truth, you prepare yourself. Meaning, one of the criticisms was he kind of revived the Hasidic practice that the Vilna Gaon was critical of not necessarily following prescribed times. And he used military analogies. He says, you know, in time of war, you can't go by the normal rules. And life is a war, those battles. And his argument was, you can't always do things by... Interesting, isn't it fascinating that he's put on trial by the Hasidic leadership for some of the same things that the Hasidic leadership was put on trial for by the Mitnagdim just 60 or 70 years earlier. Again, it kind of confirms his thesis that the revolutionaries become the establishment, because they're putting in trouble the same thing.
Doesn't Martin Luther say the same thing?
Martin Buber? Well, I don't remember. Presumably Martin Buber may have been quoting some of the Hasidic teachers. I don't remember Martin Buber himself saying that. But sure, again, it's a criticism. This is a criticism, and I'm not sitting here and telling you what Jewish law is. The Jewish law clearly requires that we pray at the right times. However, it's a recorded historical fact that Rav Wunim did not insist on that. Now we will see that his successors in Ger eventually pushed it back into the halachic framework, and you have this constant tension. And in fact, the outgrowths of Peshitska Hasidut are very, very meticulous in halakha, as we will see when we trace it to the modern day. But Rav Simcha Wunim was a little bit, at least in that one area, he departed from that a little bit. I have some quotes here. Various Hasidim criticized them, as I said, but they would try to phrase it that they weren't attacking him directly. They would say, I'm not saying anything about this rabbi, he's a true tzaddik, but his way is too dangerous for us. Or other people said, he was a great tzaddik who wishes to show the world a new way to God, but he did it before the work was completed. As a result, those who follow him take the wrong course.
Again, the argument is that
this was such an individualistic way, and the masses need structure, they need ceremony, they need to be told exactly when they're supposed to do it. Again, you know, there's so many political analogies that are suggested here that are fascinating about the inability of the masses to make these types of decisions. This was too dangerous of a course. There's a famous quote that on his deathbed, his wife is crying, and it was recorded that he said to his wife, "I've lived just so I'll know how to die." Is to be ready for that final moment. This is because Buber was fascinated with Pshitska for a lot of reasons. Some of the reasons are not so legitimate. And he was fascinated with Pshitska because he saw Pshitska as the final attempt to give life into Chassidut, which eventually died. That's his thesis, which I think I would reject. But because of this, in his Tales of Chassidim in particular, the section on the school of Pshitska is the most complete section. And through it, I just want to read you a few of these, points. He has many, many pages. That some very excellent teachings of Rabbunim are incorporated in the book. If you have the book, you can follow along with me. These are mainly short. I'm not going to read
them.
Can
you tell us the pages?
Yes, I'll give you the pages. This is volume 2. If you have the, or if you have the single volume edition, it's in the second volume. And I'll be skipping around a lot, but I just want to read a few things. On page 241, and again, I'm picking these primarily to be representative of his philosophy. One thing is very important. There are no miraculous stories about Rav Buna, because Pshitska did not talk about miracles. Pshitska talked about spiritual introspection. I just make that particular point. You know, he said, as it were, he didn't cause rain to come down. He tried to make revolutions within the hearts and souls of people. So the story here goes, in the days when Rav Bunim still traded in lumber, a number of German merchants in Danzig asked him why he went to visit the Tzadikim. Why did he go to the Tzadikim when he was younger, since he knew so much of what was in the books? Aren't the books just as good as the living examples? Later that night, they went to the theater. He did not join them. And when they came back, they said, "You should have seen the play. It was wonderful." And Rav Bunim said, "I read the program. I know the play." And they said, "But reading about it isn't the same as seeing it." He said, "Well, you just answered your question. Seeing an example of a righteous person is not the same as reading about it in the book." And on page 246, there's an interesting story how Rav Bunim says it is so easy to fall into patterns of behavior, habits. How do you go into your old habits? You've made progress, you think you're vigilant. Again, he really had a view of life as war. Not so much a war against other people, but a war against the complacency and apathy within yourself, and how even mitzvot can become so routinized that they no longer represent a real spiritual. It's about a watchman who brooded. A great nobleman once had a racehorse in his stable, etc. The watchman is sitting and brooding and concentrating to be sure the horse doesn't escape. And meanwhile, his mind starts wandering, and he's saying, "I'm wondering, where does the clay go when you drive a nail into the wall? You put a nail into the wall. Where does the material go that the nail pierces? Where does it go into?"
"And what is the material?"
"Well, yeah, I understand." So the master said, "Just keep thinking about it. Maybe the answer will come to you." Then an hour later, he sees the watchman still thinking and thinking and thinking. And he says, "I'm wondering, where does the batter go when you make a donut?" And the owner says, "Just keep thinking." Then he goes to the owner and says, the owner sees him an hour later and says, "What are you brooding on now?" He says, "I'm just wondering, where does the horse go when the door seemed to have been closed?" Because he was carrying the horse in the stable. But somehow, with all of his thinking, the horse got away. That sometimes these things happen when you least expect it. Vigilance. See, again, he's not preaching a chassidut, you know, happy-go-lucky, which sometimes we get the impression with the Baal Shem Tov a little bit, that just be happy, right? How does the song go?
Don't worry,
be happy. That's a gross oversimplification. That's a gross oversimplification. Baal Shem Tov did not say that. But sometimes it was taken to that.
What did he write?
What did he write? He didn't write anything. there's even a reason why he did it. Well, he actually said that, the Kutzker Rebbe, his disciple, was once asked why didn't he write anything. And the Kutzker Rebbe said, why should I write something? I write something, somebody's only going to read it. During the week, no one has time to read it. On Shabbat, they'll read it after lunch. They'll sit on the couch after eating a bowl of cholas. Put a bowl over my book, and I'll drop it and be on the floor. So I don't have to write books that'll be on the floor on Shabbat after doing that. Again, this was the Kutzker Rebbe. It's generally kind of a misanthrope. Rabbanim did not write. We do have collections. We do have many collections of aphorisms. There's a book on Chumash called Kol Simcha, which is from Rabbanim. The Gerer dynasty quotes Rabbanim extensively, so you can actually anthologize from the Gerer writings, the Sfat Emet, Kedushei Harim, Sfat Emet, and the later Rebbe's, Imrei Emet, and even the modern books to this day. There are many, many statements from Rabbanim, and Rabbanim is quoted by many, many of his Hasidic contemporaries. But again, Rabbanim does not have a book of systematic philosophy, that's for sure. The teachings are totally in these very sharp aphorisms, parables, and stories. In fact, according to Hasidic historians, other than the Baal Shem Tov, there are more kind of anecdotes and aphorisms attributed to Rabbanim than any other Hasidic leader. Now, Rav Nachman of Breslov, we know, has lengthy and complicated stories, as well as Kabbalistic teachings. Rav Nachman of Breslov is also a very prolific writer. Rabbanim really did not get involved in the two pockets that we mentioned. That's the Buddha quotes that as well. That's the famous teaching, Anochi Afar V'Ether, Bishvili Nivra HaOlam. Then on page 252, again I'm skipping, but I just wanted to point out some highlights. On page 252, we have two very interesting stories. One, again, this highlights the contradictory aspect of his character. One is the dangers of not getting too involved in your thoughts. Sometimes you just got to do things without thinking about them too much. And the other is the importance of thinking about what you're doing. The first story is, it's not really a story, it's just something that was recorded. He once honored a person in his Beit Knesset to blow the shofar, and the person began to concentrate on all the Kabbalistic cover notes, all of the very deep and complicated thoughts, and the woman just yells in the middle of the service, "Fool, just go ahead and blow it." Meaning that there is a point in which action must predominate over reflection. Too much reflection can paralyze a person. And if you paralyze a person, ultimately nothing in the world gets done. So this kind of highlights, get the job done, even if it's not going to be perfect. There's even a saying in English where we say that the best is the enemy of the better. Meaning to say that sometimes we don't strive to make things better because of that. See, it's not going to be perfect. This story kind of says, go ahead and do it, even if it's imperfect, but you get the job done. The second story, which I'm not sure, you know, this is very similar to that famous short story by Isaac Leib Peretz. You may have heard. It is not at all beyond the realm of possibility that Peretz basically borrowed it from an old Hasidic story. There's no, it's very, very possible that he did. But if you remember Butcher, maybe that's more familiar about the poor oppressed Jew who went through his whole life suffering, and finally he dies and he goes to heaven. Anything you want in the universe, it's all yours. You know, you have suffered, you have earned it. The rewards of eternity are yours. And the person has been so broken and so demoralized, he can only ask for a soft roll of butter. This causes the heavens to cry because he was there. So Rabbanim talks about the fact, it's a slightly different emphasis. He talks about the fact that on Rosh Hashanah, when we pray to God for life, we think so much about our physical needs. You know, God, you know, give me a good house, give me a good job. And we don't really think about the deeper existential needs of our life. And he gave the mashal about a Ben Melech, a prince, who was exiled to a faraway land because his father disinherited him. And over the years, the prince became coarsened and cheapened. And he forgot that he was a prince. Now, all he cared about was, instead, in the Shema, his desire is the Deikutz, attachment to God. But over the years, we become desensitized that doesn't even know what to ask for. That's another, again, Buber is very, very good on how to report an infection. If you're interested in Prochaska, you can go back and read, skipping rocks here. On page 255, someone once said to Rabbi, this was a Hasidic Rebbe, that, this is, I'll paraphrase it, Pirkei Avot, there's a statement that says, he who runs away from honor, he says, honor will pursue you, meaning, if you try not to seek honor in your life, then honor will follow you. If you seek honor, it runs away from you. So a Hasidic Rebbe went to Rabbi, and this Rebbe did not get a lot of respect, apparently, and he said, you know, I follow the adage of Pirkei Avot, I've always run away from honor, but the honor doesn't follow me. So Rabbi Buber said, evidently she noticed that you were looking back at her. And therefore, it's no longer attracted by the games. So he says, you can run away from honor, and honor will run towards you, but only if you're not looking back. Again, you can see that certain people who heard that might feel that he was undermining them, but in other words, he was pointing out these ideas. Another teaching, this is not in the book here, but another teaching that he pointed out was that he said about, of course, even of tzaddikim, because every human being has their own function. He said, if God would come to me, what would God gain from the deal? There would still be one Avraham and one Buber. What's God's net gain? The gain is for me, but is that why I do the mitzvot? So if God, on the other hand, would say, you know, I could be the Rabbunim that I would be, that much I would get. The idea that we don't serve God for status. Again, you could say, well, did Rabbunim invent that idea? Of course not. That's in the Chumash, that's in the Talmud. But again, these are the things that he emphasized. Everything is a matter of what you emphasize. He himself seems to be a humble man. We don't have any of the statements which occasionally you encounter about superiority or not. He was a very gentle man, very calm temperament. He had a kind of an ironic wit about him, and he was a paradoxical person. As I say, he had a magnetic effect on young people in particular. They very much loved him, and they felt close to him. Interruption with family. In fact, that's a funny thing he once said. He once said when the irate parents and in-laws of his youth came to him and said, what are you doing? He said, well, you know, when I was a pharmacist, I noticed that the doctors who charged more for their services somehow got better results. When patients came mm-hmm. after, they made their business to learn more. So he says, you know, all of the insults that my children get from you and from their in-laws, that's the payment for coming to me. So now I know that by teaching after that they're paying a higher cost to see. So in a way, he said, your insults are very good for my business. They're going to allow my teachings to penetrate on a deeper level. If you look on page 257, here he says to his Hasidim, and again, I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but he says, the greatest crime of a human being are not the sins that they commit, because temptation is powerful and our strength is weak. But the greatest crime is not realizing much the sin that's the sin, but it's the feeling that you have no way of tshuva, coming back to Hashem, that is the greatest crime. Curse and blessing. Yes, but this is interesting. This is a famous Devar Torah, which is always said in the name of the Chiddushei Harim, who is Rav Bunim's disciple. I see Buber quotes it in the name of Rav Bunim himself. I'm not sure if Buber is right, or why I remember it is right. But this is a famous thought by the Nahash, by the snake. If you remember, we read in the Chumash that the snake was cursed, that it would crawl on its belly, and would always eat dirt. So the question is raised, why is that a curse? Dirt is always available. What's so bad? So, again, I recall hearing in the name of the Chiddushei Harim, he said in the name of Rabbunim, who was the teacher of the Chiddushei Harim, that the answer is that's exactly the point, that the Nachash will never have a reason to turn to God in prayer, be a feeling of a void. That's a very, you can see that's a very profound thing, because what it says is, for a human being to have needs. Because sometimes when God gives you everything, it's God's way of saying, I don't care enough about you to want to interact with you. like somebody comes you want to get rid of, so you might say, give him what he wants and let's get him out of here. And that's what Hashem did to the Nachash. And Rebbeinu, of course, was giving people a message that these are the opportunities, and a prayer is there to address a need. A need is there to generate a prayer. What comes first? The need that gives rise to the prayer, it's the need to pray, which God creates needs, so we will turn to Him in prayer. That, again, this is actually rooted. This is rooted in a Talmudic teaching. The Talmud makes following statements. Why were the Imahot Akarot? Why were our matriarchs barren? Sarah didn't have children for so many years. Rivka didn't have children. So the Talmud says the following. This is the Talmud. Hakachu mitaveh letzvilatan shel tzadikim. Because the prayers of the righteous. God took something away from them. So they would come and connect in prayer.
Prayer.
So there would be prayer. Prayer is the real need. That's exactly the point. But human beings don't feel that need until there's some physical need in their life. And the Rebbeinu said, this was the, or the Yerim says, I don't know which one is, wait, I have to check that. Very often, as they say, Rebbeinu himself did not write any books. So his works are quoted in the works of others. So I have to look at the Chidushi Yerim, perhaps he quoted the name of his teacher. He's not by, I say, Rebbeinu, very often, Rebbeinu Chassidim, he is called Rebbeinu, although his full name was Rav Simcha Rebbeinu.
That story
yeah.
about the Nachash, what page was that?
That I have on page 259. Yeah, and that's actually a very famous thought that as well. So Rebbeinu was, as they say, a controversial man in his lifetime, but he was a man of peace. He was not a misanthrope by any definition. He was a very gentle person, a modest person, but a cosmopolitan person who had a touch of cynicism simply because he was a realist, and he realized that in the world we become prisoners of form over substance. He was trying to liberate, in a fairly gentle way, liberate Chassidut from the rigidity and fossilization, as it were, of what happens when a religious revival movement becomes mainstream and conventional. This was his attempt. We now come to his disciple, who took this to the farthest extreme possible. And his great disciple was Rav Menachem Mendel of Kutsk. Later part of life, called the Kutzker Rebbe. The Kutzker Rebbe is considered to be Kutzker Rebbe. He is considered to be one of the greatest enigmas of Chassidut. He mystified his contemporaries, he terrified his followers, and he's baffled his biographers. Basically, he ruled his Chassidim sometimes by fear. They were very, very frightened of him. His life was 1787 to 1859. Let's compare that with Rebbeinu. He was not much younger than his teacher. Rebbeinu was 1767. All right, the Kutzker Rebbe was 1787. He was born 20 years later. And he died 32 years later. So he did have a substantial existence after his teacher's life. Rav Menachem Mendel, same name as Lubavitcher Rebbe, by the way, but again, they're not connected at all, either ideologically or genealogically. He did not come from either a rabbinic family or a Hasidic family. His father was a poor glazier, repaired windows. But even as a young boy, Rav Menachem Mendel was known as very headstrong, unruly, independent, and prone to feeling isolated. He was very, very brilliant. Mm-hmm. And he always had a sense, as sometimes you have when you have prodigies who are born in, let's say, relatively simple environments, they feel they don't belong. And he did have a strong sense of loneliness and alienation. He had very little respect for virtually anybody because he just felt that they were not enough in that sense. In fact, he used to say that the only teacher he really respected, he said, the alphabet I know is true. He says, anything else somebody talking, that may be false. The alphabet I can respect because that is the unbiased truth. At the age of 20, he gravitated towards the ways of Chassidim. In fact, he even says, matter of fact, reprimanded him. His father said, that's not the way of our family. Why are you going to this new group? this verse in the Song of the Red Sea, where it says, Zeh keli va'anveyu, this is my God, and I shall glorify him. The person has to find his way to God, and then he can deal with his father's way. My obligation is to find my way to God, and then I'll respect your way. But I have to find my way first. And annotated to the Chose of Lublin, but of course the Chose of Lublin was busy with the many, many people that he was taking care of, so naturally, of course, the Kutzker went Kadosh, the Holy Jew, and when the Holy Jew died, he became a disciple of Rav Simcha. Interesting, just to give you an example of how the Kutzker Rebbe really had no fear of any man. He was very attached as a young disciple to the Yehudi HaKadosh, to the Holy Yid. And when the Yid died, Menachem Mendel felt isolated. He felt that he lost his real father, his spiritual father. It goes that the Yehudi HaKadosh appeared to him in a dream and said, Mendel, I will continue to be your teacher from heaven. Come to me because you no longer understand my predicament, and therefore you don't understand me. Just tell them that not to come. Okay. Anyway, he became a disciple of his colleague, really, Rav Simcha Bunin. He was a younger colleague, and he became a disciple. And Rav Simcha Bunin was very drawn to the Kutzker. He saw in the Kutzker, because he was melancholy and depressed, and he tried to work with him and discuss and teach him and etc. Anyway, after Rav Simcha Bunin died, the Kutzker, it wasn't called the Kutzker, but Menachem Mendel, settled in the city of Tomaszów in Poland. And he became really a legend in his time. There were songs written about it. It's very, very funny. Well, we might have put what you'll be hearing in a few minutes. It's strange, but people sang songs of joy about making the pilgrimage to Tomaszów. They would talk about a fire is burning in Tomaszów, a new light. Hundreds of people, similar to Rav Bunin, but even more so, came to the Kutzker. They lived impoverished existences. They left their families just to study with him, to learn with him, to hear Torah from him, to be inspired by him. And really, it was quite a revolution among the youth in Poland. And in fact, the song, part of that same song went, to Kutzk one does not travel, he later moved to Kutzk, to Kutzk one does not travel, to Kutzk one ascends, like going to the Beit HaMikdash, one makes Aliyah to Kutzk. What was so odd, though, is, it's hard in a way to try to encapsulate what the great appeal was, unless you were a masochist. Rav Bunin, who had much of the same sarcasm and irony, and somewhat of a spare sometimes, but Rav Bunin had a very gentle Rebbe at all in the accepted sense of the word. Number one, he despised the humble Hasidim who came for a blessing, kind of a simple person to bless me, Rebbe. He had no respect for the wealthy who wanted to give him money. He didn't take any money from anybody. In fact, there's a story that says there was a wealthy Jewish woman in Warsaw in the middle of the 19th century. She actually is kind of a minor character in many Hasidic stories. Her name was Tamara. Tamara, so Tamara in Yiddish. And she used to give a lot of money to all sorts of institutions. And she was once giving a lot of money to Rav Bunin's, because the poor people were hanging around. And the Rav Nachum Mendel came in, and he was wearing clothes, so the materials coming out of it. And Tamara's distributor said, oh, I forgot to give you some money. Here's some money for you. Peter said, the way the Kutzker said money gave him such a feeling of disgust for money that he could not handle money for 2 weeks. There was such a disgust for what money represented. So you couldn't buy it. He had no particular favoritism to taking donations or anything else.
He didn't like the wealth.
That's right. The only thing that mattered to him was the integrity of a person's spiritual search. So in Kutz, there was no hierarchy, there was no rank. Rabbis were not called rabbis. In fact, I think I may have told the story before Yom Kippur, that one of the greatest rabbis of the generation, a non-chassid, was Rabbi Akiva Eger, and his grandson became a chassid, which was in the family. And Rabbi Akiva Eger sent someone to look about the whereabouts of his grandson. And his grandson was hanging around Kutz, and the attendant comes in formal regalia, as befitted a shaliach of an esteemed rabbi, and said, we're looking for the great-grandson of the great Hagaon HaTzadik, the great excellency of Tzadik, Rabbi Akiva Eger, etc. Do you know where he is? And people are just sitting around, and they're totally not into courtesy, or not into any of that. hierarchy, and they say, never heard of him. And finally somebody says, oh, you mean Akiva's grandson? Yeah. They call him, the greatest rabbi of the generation by his first name. So in Kutsk, they were not into any type of pretension. And in fact, he would constantly insult and berate people who came to him for blessings. He would say, what do you want? Oxen, horses, kopecks? What do you want from me? He says, you think, you know, you're so righteous because you want a rabbi to give you another horse? Is that the goal of your existence? Again, he's taking the idea that life is more than accumulation of
wealth. Well, you're the Hillel and Shammai. Shammai was a biting kind of person,
yeah.
Not sympathetic.
Yeah.
I mean, but that's a good way to be.
No, no. I would not say for most of us it's a good way to be. But again, he is a person that is not subject to the accepted categories of judgment. I'm not putting him up as a model for us to follow. I will say, though, that as amazing as it sounds, he attracted thousands and thousands of people. People think he shocked people into wrecking people. Sometimes a way to get people was his shita, his approach. Sometimes by insulting. He was brutally, candidly honest. A rich follower once asked him, Rebbe, do you think I'll ever get a share in the world to come? So the Kutzker Rebbe told him, you don't even enjoy this world. You've worked incessantly for this world. How do you think you'll get the world to come when you haven't even tried to do anything for that one? You know? So he's combining. Now imagine in that kind of retort, how many separate ideas he's bringing out. He's bringing out the fact that often we toil so much of this world and we never even enjoy it. He's bringing out the fact that we forget about how to get the world to come, so to speak, by Torah and Masim Tovim, and how a person has to redirect your priorities, and earning money, etc., that there's not going to be...
But it also sounds like he's an egotist.
Again, he's a very, very enigmatic person. I mean, departed from many of the standard midotes. But again, if you measure a person by the effectiveness of his teaching, he did have a great impact on people. He's a problematic character. I'm not holding him as a role model for us to emulate. Yeah, he's really one of them.
Yeah, acclimated himself at the end of the book.
Well, I'll come to that. For 20 years he was ridiculous.
Earlier, when you were talking about... People were perhaps following him as if they were hypnotized.
But the thing was, he didn't want it. He told people constantly, go home, leave me, don't bother me, I don't want to talk to you. He was not trying to attract people. He told people to go away. And they came to him anyway, because they wanted to learn from him. So he really had a hypnotic effect on people. But it was not by saying, you know, join me and I'll show you the way to live. It was, you know, what exactly was he? Well, the attraction was really the fact that he was a person of no pretension. Now, again, you have to understand that this could very, very easily disintegrate into something very, very bad. Meaning to say, this goes back to the issue, when does nonconformity become conformity? Meaning to say, if you adopt this automatic stance that whatever the world does, we just do the opposite because we don't follow the world like sheep, but then you become a sheep in a different way because you condition your response to be the opposite of what everybody else does. So I'm a conformist. If you wear red, I'm always going to wear blue. And indeed, within Kutsk, within the masses of people that were there, there were many people who were not necessarily spiritual seekers, but people who just decided, hey, this is great. We get to be nonconformists. We get to throw out authority. We get to accuse the whole world of being dishonest and being insincere. And this is a license for us not to engage in our spiritual soul-searching. Now, this, suffice it to say, was the opposite of what the Kutzker intended, but nevertheless, this was a school that indeed, if Rav Bruno's school was dangerous, Kutsk is even more so. But the point is, we will see that the Kutzker Rebbe had a deep and bitter disillusionment with the ability of human beings to
treat. Did he marry?
Yes, he married. He did marry. He did from him. But it's very, very clear that he spent very little time with his wife. It is recorded that before he married, he had the type of life he would live. And he claimed there was a mutual understanding.
In those days.
again, let me just mention some of the, again, he did not write any books. But his teachings are preserved in many, many aphorisms. By the way, Abraham Joshua Heschel wrote a two-volume biography of the Katzalot. And this is the only work that he wrote in Yiddish. He could not write it in English or Hebrew, because he says, I cannot write about the Katzke Rebbe except in Yiddish. He says, no other language can really capture the type of personality that he was. As you would expect, he attached no importance to miracles. He used to say that he's capable of reviving the dead, but he would rather revive the living. He says, to make a living person not dead is much greater than making a dead person alive. He talked about the fact that he compared the Luchot Rishonot, the first tablets that Moshe brought down from Sinai, were smashed, and the Torah really lasted from the second Luchot. And he said, why is the second Luchot more permanent than the first Luchot? Because the first Luchot were totally by God. Human beings did not work for them. God cut them, and God inscribed them. The second Luchot, Moshe cut them out of the rock. And the Katzke Rebbe therefore emphasized that when a person was talking about the idea, in fact, this is how he, again, a Talmudic teaching. If a person says, I have toiled and I have not been successful, we don't believe it. And the Katzke used to tell that one puts into the efforts is the success. It is not the results. It is the toil. This is what he's teaching. He's, again, taking Rav Bunin's point about life being a war. But he's saying, you work, and you struggle, and you talk. He was not a moderate. I think you studied Maimonides about going in the middle of the road. Shavil HaZahav, the golden cat. Well, the Katzke Rebbe made a comment about the Maimonidean Aristotelian formulation that, as far as he knows, only horses stay in the middle of the road. thinking about the Polish countryside, and he says, he even added a little bit of a scatological reference, and those who follow the horses wind up stepping in. So he says, you gotta take a stand. He says, you have to take a stand. And in fact, he quotes the quote in Midrash. There's an interesting Midrash that says, when God wanted to create Adam, so there were arguments pro and con. It says, Emet, truth came to God and said, don't create man, shekulo shikarin, he is full of lies. Shalom, peace came to God and said, don't create man, shekulo ketata, he is full of machloket, dissension. So what God did was, it says, God, this is the Midrash, God threw truth out of the ring, and then God said, now I can create man. So the Katzke Rebbe says, well, what about shalom? Shalom is still arguing. So the Katzke Rebbe says, no, when you get rid of truth, it's easy to have peace. He says, when you don't stand, get rid of them next, then you show up. Katzke Rebbe's making the point. It's actually very relevant to contemporary debates when we talk about various compromisings and dilution because of shalom. But the Katzke Rebbe says, that's only going to work when you get rid of your emet. There has to be emet as well. And the Katzke Rebbe, of course, in life and in Judaism, there's always going to be a tension between the values of emet and the values of shalom. That he is on the side of emet. Another famous thought, which parallels Rav Bunin's idea that you have to be aware of your greatness as well as your humility. This is a famous thought I think you've heard before. This is from when the spies came back with their negative report about the land of Israel. They said, we were in our eyes like grasshoppers compared to the giants, and so we were in their eyes. So the Katzke Rebbe says, if in your eyes you're a grasshopper, that's how other people will see you. Fulfilling prophecy. That's why it didn't say we were grasshoppers in their eyes until it first said we were grasshoppers in our eyes. Then we have the famous statements where he was asked, where does God live? And he says, wherever you let him in, you have to let him in. Probably when someone would come to him to study, is not lost, you're lost. And therefore you have to find yourself, and you're going to find God. So he was a man of tremendous lofty idealism, but as the years got by, he got disillusioned. In fact, he used to say he really didn't want masses of people coming to him. He used to say he would like to go into the desert. But at various times, there were certain statements Yeah, I really don't want to sit in judgment on a great Rebbe, but where he really said, like, he compared himself in some way, he compared himself to Moshe Rabbeinu. He would like to go into the deserts, gather a few disciples, and he said he would feed them the manna. They couldn't be changed. Most people live lives of habits, live lives of, they do things the way they always did it. And he had no patience for that. That's not what he wanted to do. And yet, people were coming and coming and coming to him. He called himself Shabbat. He pointed out that he was the seventh generation from the Baal Shem Tov. You have the Baal Shem, in fact, you can even trace this. Baal Shem Tov, the Magid of Mezerich, the Mezerich of Magid, Rav Elimelech. Okay. Yes, the Baal Shem Tov. The Baal Shem Tov's successor was the Magid of Mezerich. And then Elimelech Milizhentz. Elimelech was the Chose of Lublin. Yehudi HaKadosh, Rav Bunin, and the Kutzker. If you follow that line, he said he was the Shabbos, he was the quintessence. He was the encapsulation of all that they represented. This is what he said. He said, and he thought that he incorporated it all, and he could change the generation if he just had a few followers. But he couldn't, because he was constantly dealing with these masses of people. All right. In 1840, things finally came to a severe head. 1840, he was 1787, so he was 53 years old. It was Friday night. The Hasidim talked about night around midnight, there was something that night. What he did that night, no one ever really says. The Mithnagdim make a story that he actually extinguished the candles. He said it when he desecrated Shabbat. He extinguished the candle. Others say he touched the candlestick, which is a minor violation. Others say he took the wine of Kiddush and he spilled it on the table. Others say all he said was, on Shabbat, Friday night.
So he did anything
Chilul Shabbat. Well, either Chilul Shabbat or pouring the wine is not Chilul Shabbat, but it's something not proper. Others say all he did was he yelled at his followers and he said, "Get out of here, you fools. I am neither a rabbi nor the son of a rabbi." He just said, "Leave me alone." He fainted. He was carried into his room with very great difficulty to revive. Next 19 years of his life, it was double doors. Not a total week, because it's very interesting that during those 19 years, there only a few people were allowed to visit him. Some of them were the greatest scholars. Zirin, the founder of Gera Chassidut, Yitzchak Meir, who will learn, used to see him. The Kutzker's son-in-law was a great, great... Allah and in Halakha, that the Kutzke Rebbe was a master in all of those things. In fact, the Kutzke Rebbe during those 19 years systematically burnt everything, with every Erev Pesach, with the Chametz, he would burn pages of his writings. Right? Hundreds of pages of his writings. Now again, this may very well have been essentially a nervous breakdown, or whatever it is. He did see people, and everyone, and the strange thing was, I mean, you know, he was adjacent to the Beit Midrash. Obviously he was not with his wife, he wasn't in his time at all. There was a hole in the door, he used to hear the Kriyat Torah. He was even called for Aliyot. He would come out, he'd have a palace over his head, he would have the Aliyah, he would just go back right in, like he wouldn't look at anybody. I mean, imagine the apparition of someone, you know, Howard Dover said, walking out on him. And yet, hundreds of people still hung around, because every once in a while, he would come out. It's like frightening. People would go under the table, they would hide in the corner. He would come out, you know, and he would start, you know, yelling and screaming. He would be saying, he would be saying words of Torah, but very, very frightening. And, it was a very, very difficult, he would say. For 19 years, he was a Rebbe. Because they said, much of his teachings were preserved from people like the men and other people coming to see him during those 19 years. He was not a total Rebbe. It said he would leave the room every Erev Pesach, he would leave the room so they could search it for chametz. You're sitting in a shul, and you got those two double doors, and he's behind the doors. And he can come out anytime. He can come out at 4 in the morning. I mean, anytime they start to come out.
He prayed, he davened, when he wanted to.
We don't really know. In fact, amongst us, there's a big thing about going to the mikveh. They were the worst in the mikveh, and that was a very big custom among the Hasidim in particular. Yes. That just like there was the traveling well of Mir Young. He had a traveling well in his which was a but what he said was during his years of seclusion, he had no statement that he said, because he did talk to his son-in-law, he did talk to Yishai Harim, was he says his whole world is not even worth a sigh. Very, very unusual figure. He said that this world is so irredeemable that it's not even worth being unhappy over. Because you're unhappy over something. Well, you're unhappy over something that you can improve that you haven't. It's something that beyond repair. Very, very difficult. And, you know, one could have imagined, this is a paradox, one could have imagined that this could have been the dead end, this could have just been the end of everything. I mean, what are you going to have after this? And yet, ironically, it was not, because of the Rim and other people. They took the good out of his teachings, and they continued to try to revitalize Hasidut. So the Kutzke Rebbe is a very, very tragic figure. Just to give you another example, though, about the concept of sincerity. This is still not about the Kutzke Rebbe, but one of his disciples. One of his disciples was on his deathbed, and the disciples, what do you think about us in the last moments? Is there still the Yetzer Hara? Is there still the evil inclination? And the moment of death, they asked the person who's dying. And the person said, yes, there is. And I'll tell you what it is. At the moment of death, my Yetzer Hara tells me I should shout out Shema Yisrael, like the last moment when a person dies, they try to say, Hear, O Israel, God is one. And my Yetzer Hara tells me I should do that, because that way I know that everybody around my bed will say, oh, what a righteous man. What a righteous man that his last words are Shema Yisrael. He says, you know, I'm not going to do that, because I don't want to give in to the pride of having everybody think I'm so righteous. The kind of idea that the last moments of life, a person has that idea of not being unrighteous. So again, we'll talk more about the Kutzke next week. But in addition, we'll go into the Yishai Harim, the Mayor Ware, which again, as I say, the potential for the Kutzke to simply have destroyed the Hasidic movement in Poland on one level seems to have been great. And yet, ironically, by incorporating his teachings in a positive way, it became very, very strong. And the lesson is that truth sometimes is very painful. called the School of the Shishkat, which began with the student of the Hazar of Lublin, the Yehudi HaKadosh, the Holy Jew, and then it led to a Simcha Bunim, and then it led to what could have been a dead end, so in terms of the anarchy that was implicit in the school of thought, and that was the Rebbe of Kutsk, Menachem Mendel of Kutsk. His last name actually was Morgenstern, although it wasn't his last name, that was an assumed name, because to avoid the Russian draft. And the Kutsk Rebbe is certainly one of the most perplexing figures in Chassidut. And as we mentioned last week, and as you know probably from before, the last 20 years of his life, he was essentially a recluse, coming out occasionally. He did have interaction with some of the Gedolei Chassidut, some of his great disciples. He was not totally in isolation, but he did not really come out to speak to the masses, except once in a while. And when he did it, they were often so frightened that they would hide under the table or run out of the room. They would wait for weeks to have him come out, and when he came out, they just couldn't stand to be with him. I know that many people have problems, and again, I can't say that I fully understand it either. Kutsker was obviously a character of great complexity, and in some ways embodies characteristics that we would not normally associate with a Jewish spiritual leader. We talked about many of the figures of Chassidut and not Chassidut as people of kindness and compassion and the like. And this is not the image we have of the Kutsker, but first of all, you have to recognize two things. The sharpness of the Kutsker's behavior was manifested towards those who came to him to be his disciples. Meaning to say, if you met somebody in the streets, just a regular Jew, the Kutsker probably said hello to him, probably spoke to him, probably asked how he was doing. We're not talking about interactions in the world at large, although he probably didn't have that many interactions in the world at large. But when people came to him for disciples, as disciples, he felt he had a religious and moral duty to make them recognize the truth. And he recognized that shock value was sometimes very, very appropriate. That he saw a Judaism, and I think the point we made last week was the whole essence of the Peshischa school arose out of the crisis of Chassidut, which had been a revival and a renewal, has now become the norm. They have now become the establishment. And he saw a tremendous, and the Kutsker saw this very, very graphically, that when the rebellion becomes the establishment, they fall into the same rut and the same patterns of behavior. And he had to have a reawakening. Again, just as Satan had a to get Chas Shalom Mahabdil, many Havdalot. But Rav Zitzchak did very much advocate the concept of perpetual revolution, simply because when you try to create a new order, there is always the danger of falling into stagnation. In a very, very different way, and for many different reasons, the Kutsker also felt it was important not to be too settled in your ways. And at the very point in which people thought they had found the way, Kutsker wanted to disagree. He takes the position that the primary goal of spiritual life is the journey itself, and not any particular process of striving. And ironically, as long as you have a sense that you have not arrived, you have found something. You have arrived, you've lost it. And therefore, his overarching goal was for people to was to make the people under his wing realize that in fact there was no final answer that he was offering them. And then last, obviously this teaching was not a teaching that the average Jew who needed definite guidance would be able to go to, that many people couldn't absorb. And I'm not sure what the medical criteria was. In those days, there was no science of psychology, so to say, so these things weren't diagnosed. But certainly we haven't recorded that he was in isolation for almost 20 years. I mentioned last week that the famous event of that Shabbat, on the Shabbat, something happens, and the Kutsker fainted. I do want to mention that there was also a palace revolt that occurred as a result of that Shabbat. A group of very, very esteemed disciples left the court of the Kutsker Rebbe after it, and they founded a sub-school of very, very great eminence. And that sub-school, I'll tell you the person who broke away. The person who broke away was a disciple of Mordechai Yosef Liner. you'll see this is rather important, of the city of Ishbitz.
Where is that?
This is all Polish Hasidut. We're all talking about Poland at this point. Poland did have the largest Hasidic group, and all of it came from the Chozer of Lublin, and these are various breakaways and the like. Ishbitz, he's called the Ishbitzer Rebbe. Now, he wrote a book on Chumash called the Mei Shiluach, which basically means the fountain of Shiluach, that's the Mei Shiluach. And interestingly enough, he's been rediscovered by some very modern sources. If you read carefully, this, even if you can look in the index just to confirm this, that she actually quotes the Ishbitzer 5 or 6 times, the Mei Shiluach. So it actually attracts the attention of many modern people who are into literary criticism and psychological insight. The Ishbitzer was a very, very profound thinker. He kind of absorbed from Simcha Bunim without kind of the bitterness of the Chasker Rebbe. And he had some very profound psychological insight. One of his main themes is to explore the tension between free will and divine providence. This, of course, is a philosophical question. It's as old as Maimonides, but actually it's much older. Maimonides himself discusses, and you probably went over this, the inherent paradox of God's total knowledge of what we're going to do with the fundamental axiom that human beings have free will. Meaning, Maimonides makes the point that every human being has the unfettered free will to choose to do good or evil. And yet, God knows what I'm going to do tomorrow. Now, if God knows I'm going to sin tomorrow, how can it be when I get up in the morning, I can decide not to sin? If I can decide not to sin, then God didn't really know. If God knows, I don't have the choice, right? So Maimonides develops an idea how God's knowledge does not necessarily compel the choices that human beings make. Maimonides' critic, Rav Avraham ben David, the rabbit, and he kind of attacks Maimonides at various points, basically writes in his usual sharp fashion that if Maimonides couldn't give a good answer to the question, he shouldn't raise a question. Better not to raise questions you don't know how to answer than to raise a question that you're not able to answer. He says, this way the simple people don't have the question, there won't be any problems. But anyway, Rav Maimon, the Mei Shiluach, tries to address these problems at great length, and he also tries to integrate philosophy with Kabbalah. In fact, you may be noticing that the trend of Polish Hasidut until the Ishbitzer breakaway was actually moving away from Kabbalah. The Kutzker, for example, even Rav Simcha Bunim, they had great psychological insights, traditional rabbinical studies, and they were moving away, integrated into a philosophical tradition. Again, Rav Mordechai Yosef was at first a colleague of the Kutzker in studying under Rav Simcha Bunim. He then became a disciple of the Kutzker. But upon this Shabbat event, he broke away, and he even talked about this as Shavirat Haluchot. Yosef said about the Kutzker, there has been Shavirat Haluchot at Kutzk. Shavirat Haluchot, of course, is the breaking of the tablets. He says, the tablets of God were here, but the Kutzker has smashed the Luchot, and the Shekhinah has left Kutzk. It's a big, big power struggle. Again, obviously depends on exactly what was done that Friday night, but apparently it had a momentous impact on a number of the Goli Chassidut. Now, I just want to trace very briefly the Ishbitzer breakaway, and then I'm going to go back to Kutzk. But Mordechai Yosef Weiner, of course, one person that he took with him, was a Hasid who came from the most esteemed Mitnaged family in the world, perhaps Shlomo the Vilna Gaon himself. And that is Rabbi Akiva Eger, was a great, great Gaon in Halakha, who was a Mitnaged. He was a very strong Mitnaged. His son, who's Rabbi Eger, called in Yiddish, Rabbi Leibel Eger, became a Kutzker Hasid. He became a Hasid of the Kutzker Rebbe. Followed by Mordechai Yosef in studying. Rabbi Leibel Eger broke away with Mordechai Yosef Weiner, and there was a third person who joined them later, who was Yitzhak Kohen. I'll say a few words about Yitzhak Kohen. Actually was from the Mitnaged family. He was not from a Hasidic family. He was in the 1900s, so he's already in the latter half of the 19th century. I think he was born in 1820, died in 1900. He was a phenomenal genius. It is said that he had mastered the whole Talmud, the whole Babylonian Talmud, by the age of eight. Mm. Which is, beyond genius of Mordechai Yosef. Over 30 years, in spite of his great learning and acumen, in the background, first Rav Mordechai Yosef, and Rav Tzadok did not become Rebbe. He refused teaching and having Talmidim himself as a Hasid. He said he's a Hasid, he's not a Rebbe. And until he was 60, he was kind of the elder, very respected elder in the movement, but very silent. There are many, many stories about his first encounter with Mordechai Yosef, the Midna Gates. And in fact, there's some sad story here. Now, clear, he was in the process of divorcing his first wife, and he needed to obtain the consent of many rabbis. He became acquainted with all of the Hasidic and Midnagate rabbis throughout Eastern Europe, and he became recognized as a rabbi. And one day he wandered into Rav Mordechai Yosef's synagogue. And we know at the time that the Hasidic custom was, that is when the rabbi would extend. These words had such an impact on him that he felt it was as if somebody had opened up his heart. A very, very devoted follower. But in truth, all of those years of silence, they're called the years of silence, he was writing books and books and books and books and books. From the pen of Rav Tzadok, we have around 30 volumes published, and many of which were not published, on all areas of the Torah. Rav Tzadok is a very, very profound thinker. He's a great Kabbalist. He draws on Zohar, the writings of the Ari, on all branches of rabbinic literature, on philosophy, historian as well. He has some very interesting theories about history. We have private diaries of interpretations of his dreams. He used to keep journals about the dreams that he had. We have diaries similar to Pascal's thought, reflections. So he left a very large genre of literature, much of which he did not intend to publish, much of which was published after his life. You can get those books. These books are available in a good Jewish bookstore, but very, very little, very, very little has been translated into English. Occasionally you might see an anthology of one or two pages. But the bulk of it is fundamentally untranslatable. Some of the diary entries can be translated. Somebody ought to do that, actually. But the more lengthy expositions are almost incomprehensible because they do require that knowledge. Meaning, he does not explain a given text. He assumes you know what that text means, and he runs with it and brings it together. Now, Rav Tzadok is one of the Hasidic masters that is very well respected, even in the yeshiva world of non-Hasidic, meaning to say, things that someone tries to emulate if they're into any type of to try to study some of the writings of Rav Tzadok, one's erudition and one's learning. Now, let me just share with you a few thoughts about it. The reason I mention him again is just to keep it in context. Rav Tzadok was part of the Ishpitzer school that actually broke away from the Kutzker Rebbe. Now, they always had respect for the Kutzker Rebbe. The Kutzker Rebbe was not repudiated, but as it was said, the Luchot were smashed. We must go elsewhere. But they still spoke of the Kutzker Rebbe with a lot of respect, and they just felt that you can't be with it anymore. Something happened in which we have to distance. One thought, I think, in the very first week, I mentioned to you from Rav Tzadok, now you know the name, you can connect the thought. We talked about the thunder and the lightning, if you remember, at Mount Sinai. Yes. I won't repeat the whole thing, but you can go back to your emphasis of holiness between a holiness that is predicated on separation and renunciation, brilliant ecstasy, plunged into total darkness, and the torch which flickers, but that's the ability of integrating holiness into the world. It's bright, but there's a constancy to it. And he was teaching, of course, the Hasidic teaching. Other books as Avodah Shebagashmiyot, service of God, Avodah, in the material world. Rav Tzadok brings it out very beautifully in this. I'll tell you another thought. I'm just telling you a thought from Rav Tzadok just so you get a sense of it. I think about Rav Tzadok that's very, very wonderful. And that is, although the imagery and the texts are all technical Kabbalistic texts, so it's very, very difficult, his insights are not totally textual. Ultimately, their cycle applies to how a person is supposed to live the language and the symbols to extract the core idea that is there. Rav Tzadok raises an interesting question, starting from the Talmudic text. The Talmud says that each of the three tefillot, right, we daven three times a day. Shacharit, the morning prayer, Mincha, the afternoon prayer, Ma'ariv or Arvit, the evening prayer. Each of the three prayers was enacted by one of our avot. Avraham began the process of praying in the morning, added the process of praying in the afternoon, and Yaakov added the idea of praying in the evening. Right? Said in the Talmud. Now, the Talmud also says that Shacharit and Mincha, morning and afternoon prayers, are mandatory. One must do those. But Ma'ariv, the evening prayer, originally, not today, now it's become a custom, but originally, Arvit was a reshut. Arvit was an optional prayer, not a mandatory prayer. Rav Tzadok raises the obvious question, why should Yaakov's prayer be inferior to the prayer of Avraham and Yitzchak? Right? Avraham's prayer is mandatory. Yitzchak's prayer is mandatory. Yaakov's prayer is somehow inferior. Actually, it's the opposite. In rabbinic tradition, Yaakov is praised as the greatest of the patriarchs because Avraham had good son, bad son, Yitzchak Yishmael. Yitzchak had good son, bad son, Yaakov and Esav. But all of Yaakov's children, in spite of their problems, rivalry, etc., but all of them form the Jewish people. Our Chachamim say, Yaakov is mitasau Shleiman. His bed, his progeny, mitasau Shleiman. The mitah, the progeny, are perfect. They're all the Jewish people. So Rav Tzadok asks an obvious question that really any Talmud student would ask this question, or should ask this question. Why is Arvit, the evening prayer, optional if it comes from Yaakov? So listen to what he says, and think about this stone approach to prayer. It's a beautiful, beautiful. Why are prayers correlated to times of day? Morning, right? The morning prayer should ideally be said as the sun is rising. Prayer should be said as the sun is setting. And the Ma'arit prayer is... In a society which of course has electric light and permanent illumination, day and night doesn't make much of a difference to us. We can do the same thing at night that we do in the day, etc. But think about the ancient world, not such an ancient world, 150 years ago. Night and day were very sharply differentiated. And he says, the prayers correspond to the times of day because there is a dominant mood in each prayer which captures the emotions of a human being at those given moments. And he says the following, Shacharit, a prayer as the sun rises, is the prayer of hope and gratitude. When a person gets up in the morning, a person might be tired, etc., but very, very often there's a sense of hope. You know, even if things have been difficult, there's a new day, there's a new morning. So the dominant feeling of Shacharit is gratitude for the opportunities that God gives us, and a sense of hope and renewal. Halakha even says, interestingly enough, that when you visit the sick, there's a mitzvah to visit the sick. Visit the sick the first 3 hours of the day. If things are okay, you won't pray for them. Mm-hmm. So it says, don't go the first 3 hours of the day because you will minimize the seriousness of the condition. Don't go towards the end of the day because that's when people tend to feel the worst. And you might feel that it's hopeless and you might discourage. Go in the middle of the day when a person isn't too good, isn't too bad, and that way you can get a realistic appraisal of the situation. So Rav Tzadok says, why did Avraham enact the morning prayer? Because Avraham's approach to God was primarily one of gratitude and love for the goodness that God... He's a morning person, indeed. Because the mood of the morning expressed Avraham's relationship to God. Right? Avraham, although he had his trials, of course, but Avraham was, he was respected, and the final thing that he wanted was mincha. What is the dominant feeling of mincha? Imagine, of course, every sunset doesn't induce this emotion, but you know, in the world, when there were eclipses, people thought the world was ending. There was a certain horrifying aspect of the sun going down that was really very foreign to us today. But, you know, Think about the New York Stock Exchange, huh?
It's a good one.
Think about the New York Stock Exchange, which closes at 4 or 5. And if you ever look at it, right before they're closing, they got one more minute to get everything in before the bell. And there's a mad rush. In an agricultural society, in a pre-electric light society, the coming of night, you have to finish before night. We still tell our kids, come in before dark.
Yes.
Or the conscious spheres. Of course, is a metaphor for galus. Night is a metaphor for kids that lost control. Don't know what's going on. He says, Nidcha, however, is the transition. Nidcha is not night. Nidcha is the transition between day and night. And that is the person who begins to feel that they have them, but they feel precarious. They feel vulnerable. They feel under it. That's, Rav Tzadok says, is why Yitzchak was a Mincha person. In Avraham's life, Avraham was well respected by the local Canaanite populations. In Yitzchak's life, I always compare it to similar to how a Jew felt in Nazi Germany in the early 30s. Before concentration camps. But there was a sense you're not really welcome here. You know, if you remember, the Chumash will describe that the wells that Yitzchak dug, or the wells that Abraham dug, the local people fill up. Under rabbinic tradition, the 400 years of servitude, the Jews were not in Egypt 400 years. They were only in Egypt 210 years. And yet God said there will be a servitude 400 years. According to our Chachamim, the 400 years commences from the birth of Yitzchak. Mm-hmm. Although they weren't in Egypt, but somehow he was an alien. He had a sense of being a stranger, even in that. You're still rich. You're still a citizen. You still have your rights. But you begin to think life is not as secure. What is the mood of Mincha? And Yitzchak is a Mincha person that corresponds. Sure. According to the rabbinic tradition, when did Yaakov establish? The verse in the Chumash which establishes Vayifka b'makom v'yalen sham, that refers to when Yaakov took the blessing from his brother, and Yaakov is running away, and it's the middle of the daytime, but God caused the sun to set, and it was dark, and he stopped there to pray to God. And what would happen to be 63 years old? Chumash doesn't say it, but Rashi gives a very complicated case. He is 63 years old. He has no wife at this point. He has no children. According to rabbinic tradition, all of his wealth, as he's running away, Esav sends his son to take away all of Yaakov's wealth. So he's leaving penniless. He's leaving Eretz Yisrael to go to Chutz La'aretz. He's leaving the spiritual environment of Yitzchak to expose himself to the moral degradation of a Lavan. At some level, he's leaving a physical threat, but he's submerging himself in spiritual threat. That's why it became dark all of a sudden. This is not things are slipping away. You've already hit bottom. Homeless, penniless, no friend, no teacher, no one to turn to. Yes, at all. He will have something. Now remember, God did give him a vision of the ladder. Yes, but remember, that came after he prayed. He prayed and God showed him that vision. When he prayed, it was already dark. Rav Tzadok says, if Shacharit is the prayer of gratitude for all of the opportunities that God gives us, and if Mincha is turning to God and begging God, please, is the prayer of someone that as one affirms his emunah in God. It's called the prayer of emunah. The prayer of faith is what you have. And it is what a person can have even in Auschwitz. It is what a person can have under every circumstance. Job says, as he's crying to God, saying, why have you afflicted me? He says to God, yiktaleini lo ayachel. Even if, famous verse, though he slay me, I shall hope in him. Okay? You'll notice that after the Shema, we say emet, tpiyatsik. God's words are true and firmly established. In the evening, we say emet ve'emunah. God's words are true and I have faith in them. See? In the morning of our lives, presence is firmly established. In the evening of our lives, there is emuna. And that's what Tzedek says, that's also the meaning. Morning, I declare your loving kindness. And that's the morning of Amei Lutz. In the whole different insight. You know, people say, gee, Jews have the same thing, morning, afternoon, night. Where's the variety? You see, the same words have different nuances. You held holding on to those things that you need. And human beings were more attuned to the natural world, which we're not today. You did have a sense of what night meant, what sunrise meant, and these moods of nature did influence how a person approached death. Now it's all the same. That's why ideally, you know, all synagogues that have a daily minyan combine mincha and ma'ariv. You know, we don't want to have people come back at certain times. So ideally, mincha should be, you know, when it's still day. Ma'ariv should be when it's dark. The concepts here. Now, going back to the original question, remember we started off with the question, we moved far afield. The question was, why is Yaakov's prayer, Ma'ariv, relegated to an inferior status? So listen to what Rav Tzedek answers. It's an optional prayer, not because it's maybe an aspiration and not a requirement. Meaning to say, every human being can be expected to be grateful for what God is doing. Every human being knows to turn to God when things are slipping away. But how many people? Again, today it's an obligation for the tonight, but it was optional because it represents a level that not everybody could achieve. Of Tzedek Stein. Now, all of this, I'll give you an example. He may have an essay which discusses this for 5 pages, and I've told you the first 5 lines. And this is how dense and rich the thought is, that just to unpack a few lines, you know, one has this whole disquisition. But then it goes on and on and on, and develops this further and further. And we have volumes and volumes of his stuff. Some of the stuff he wrote himself, sometimes just as private notes, and some of the things were written by his disciples. Tzedek, like Tzedek. Tzedek. He's called Tzedek HaKohen. Milu Blit, Rav Tzedek, the Kohen from the Jewish name, also Rav Bila, So that's Rav Tzedek. And in terms of identifiable schools, he is of the Ishbitzer school. Now, there is no Ishbitzer school today, basically. I mean, these schools were very, very influential, but they were never numerically large. And basically, they were destroyed in the Holocaust. But the writings survive and the teachings survive, and they are the legacy to all of Klal Yisrael. And so that's works again. At least some of them certainly deserve a much wider audience.
Why do you think, or what attributed him going back to
left
for what, 3 generations or so?
Well, the Ishbitzer generally, this was really the influence of not just Rav Tzedek, although Rav Tzedek wrote much more. For example, Rav Mordechai Yosef wrote one small volume, Mei Shiluach, compared to Rav Tzedek's 30 volumes of things. Well, part of it would be basically that Rav Tzedek, if people are looking for sources of renewal, in a way, Peshitsa is a school of renewal, and Kutsk is a breakaway from Peshitsa, and Ishbitz is a breakaway from Kutsk. And the question then becomes, in looking for sources of renewal, what do you look at? The Kutzker basically said, you do it through psychological self-analysis. Kabbalah generally was often seen as a basis for renewal. Kabbalah was never fully abandoned, but it was always within the elitist groups very much studied, but set up, of course, in a very small group of people with it. But his writings are very, very influential. In fact, there are even people today, again, I have to say that the imitations are not up to the original, who write books that are entitled Explanations on the Parsha Following the Approach of Rav Tzedek. Meaning to say, it's not parody, because it's not intended to be humorous, but they try to take his approach and come up with their own ways of doing it, modeled on his approach. But as you'd expect, those who try to model his approach really don't have the same richness as his own. And again, it's really a chaval that very, very little has been translated. There's one other person of the Ishbitzer school that I think should be mentioned, and that is Rav Mordechai Yosef Weiner's either son or grandson, I don't remember right now, and that is Rav Gershon Weiner. And he founded a group of Hasidim that are called the Radziner Hasidim. Again, these are confusing names because it's under Ishbitz, but he founded a group called Radziner Hasidim. And there are, to this day, Radziner Hasidim. And Radzin is just a city in Poland. These are all Polish cities. Now, of course, the Radziner Hasidim live in Israel, primarily, and the like. And the one interesting thing about the Radziner Hasidim is that they wear the blue fringe on their tzitzits. Let me give you a little bit of that. Mm-hmm. That's how you know. Well, actually, today you can't tell anymore because there's a reason to that one. But until very recently, if you saw somebody wearing the blue fringe on the tzitzits, you knew he was a disciple of the Radziner Rebbe. Let me explain the background of this. We know, of course, the Torah itself says that on the tzitzit, on the fringes, there should be a blue string. Yeah, there's a machloket exactly. Mm-hmm. How does that work? Because the tzitzit are four strings that are folded over and make eight. So do you have one out of the eight blue or two out of the eight blue, because that would be a whole string, or four out of the eight blue, making two full strings? There are many, many different opinions. But be as it may, there is certainly a concept in the Torah itself that some of the tzitzit should be white, and some of the tzitzit should be blue, or tchelet, whatever that form of blue or purple. And the reason for that is, the Gemara tells us, is that the tchelet is supposed to be the color of the sea, and the sea is the color of the sky. White, is white represents purity, and blue represents the presence of God. Therefore, if you want to bring the blue of God into your life, you also have to live a life of whiteness and purity. Now, the Tehelet was derived from a sea creature called the Chilazon. This is in the Talmud, the Chilazon. Itself, it's not clear if the Chilazon is some type of snail or shellfish or fish, cuttlefish or whatever it is. It is a non-kosher of origin, which is very interesting. And the Chilazon was lost already in Talmudic times, etc. At various times, the Roman government did not allow people, because remember, this was a site of royalty in ancient times, and therefore Jews were not allowed to wear the Chilazon, either because of persecution or because the Chilazon disappeared or became extinct or whatever it is, the Chilazon was discontinued already towards the end of the Talmudic era. Now, the Radziner Rebbe, and by now we're talking about the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, was like Rav Tzedek, in a way. He was a person who was a child prodigy. He had mastered all forms of the Torah. But in addition, he had a very good scientific background. If Rav Tzedek gravitated towards Kabbalah, Radziner Rebbe also gravitated towards science and mathematics and astronomy. He had a great phenomenal grasp of many different forms of wisdom. Music, he was a very gifted musician and violinist as well. He was a doctor. In those days, you didn't have to go to a medical school to be an MD. But basically, he had a very good knowledge of medicine. And the Radziner went through all of the various references to the Chilazon, what it is, and he came to a certain conclusion that the Chilazon was a given, he identified as a source, therefore, that, and he got a pharmacist and a chemist to help him produce this blue dye. And therefore, all of his Hasidim wore the Tchelet based on his identification of Chilazon. And he wrote three Talmudic treatises, trying to show that this is the Chilazon. He had to prove it through the different sources and cross-references and the like. Now, interestingly enough, that teaching contradicted a teaching of the greatest Kabbalist of all, the Ari, who actually says that the Chilazon will not be discovered until the day of Mashiach. David is specifically in the writings of the Ari, but once again, the Radziner felt that he discovered the Chilazon. Now, in recent years, just the past few years, perhaps you're noticing the resurgence of the Chilazon. This is not from the same source as the Radziner Rebbe. Recently, there have been some scientists who have claimed to actual Chilazon. Yeah, it's still a shellfish, it's a type of snail. Mm-hmm. And they are producing tchelet. And the truth of the matter is, if truth be told, this is a little unfortunate story, careful chemical analysis shows that the Radziner Rebbe was duped in his identification. And the reason is the following. You see, when there are a number of snails and shellfish which produce secretions, when, if you mix them with various chemicals, will turn into a blue shade. In other words, it doesn't come out blue. It's mixed with other things. Now, chemical analysis showed, however, that the color blue in the Retinus tephalans was solely a function of the chemicals that were added. In other words, it was an inorganic color blue, and it had nothing to do with the base secretion. The base secretion could have been water, and it would have turned into blue anyway. Meaning to say, the secretion of the chilazone is not an active ingredient in the Retinus tephalans, and therefore that couldn't be it. As opposed to the alternative identification today, which can be shown that although it doesn't come out blue, but it is the catalyst in that transformation. So the Radina Chassidim still continue to work. They say, this is what I already said, this is what we do. We don't care about any more recent scientific identification. But many people who are not Chassidim, in fact, are now wearing this new Tchelet. It's very expensive. There are actually some very good web pages on it, if any of you are connected to the email. They spell it T-E-K. H-E-L-E-T. Just check it out.
Just fix off the...
That might be true. But the web pages are not. The web pages come from Israel. And you can look at it. And they'll even show you the different ways of the tzitzit, whether it should be two blue or four blue or one blue, and how you knot the blue among the white. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting project, even for children to get involved in. It is expensive. The chelet is still expensive because it's very difficult to process. But that is the one outstanding external feature about Radziner Chassidim, that they were into the chelet a long time ago, albeit it is not the chelet that is touted today as the tchelet. What's interesting is that Rav Liner tried to convince other rabbis to adopt the tchelet, and they rejected his conclusion. And in fact, the second chief rabbi of Israel, Rav Isaac Herzog, who, by the way, was the father of Chaim Herzog, the late president of the state of Israel, wrote his doctoral dissertation on the identification of the chilazon. Rav Herzog had a PhD from the University of Dublin. He actually grew up in Ireland before he came to Israel. He concluded the Radziner Rebbe's identification was incorrect based on scientific data. Rav Herzog's dissertation has been reprinted in English, and it is available. Porphyology. Porphyology is the study of snails. You know. It's a whole very, very interesting area, and the Radziner Rebbe was involved, as I say. Many have suggested he was duped by an unscrupulous chemist who was charging a lot of money to produce this blue dye, which was totally inorganic, and the secretion of the chilazon. But Rav Gershow Liner did other things as well. I'll give you one example that he did, a very tremendous contribution to the study of halakha, which might be a little arcane, but I rest assured it's extremely important. You know that in the Mishnah, there are six orders of the Mishnah, but not all of the orders have a Gemara, have a Talmud explaining the Mishnah. So for example, the order of agriculture, Zera'in, does not have a Gemara. We just have the plain Mishnah. We don't have all the elaborations because the Talmud is post-temple, and therefore there was less of a reason. But at least we have a Jerusalem Talmud on that. But the sixth order of the Mishnah, which deals with the very complicated laws of purity and impurity, about contact with dead bodies and all things else, there is no Gemara either in the Babylonian Talmud or the Palestinian Talmud. However, the way the Babylonian Talmud works, in the course of discussing one thing, it brings in a lot of things. So you can open up a piece of Talmud talking about the laws of Shabbat, and on the same page it'll mention marriage and divorce and kashrut and everything else. So what Rav Liner did was, this is an amazing thing, on each Mishnah in the order of purities, he assembled every single passage in the entire Talmudic and the prayers upon that Mishnah. In other words, he compiled a Gemara by excerpting from hundreds and hundreds of volumes every relevant thing. So it's as if you have a Gemara.
And he didn't have a computer.
That's right. So now, you could take his work, And you can, and he also wrote commentaries on it as well. He wrote commentaries on those passages. So in effect, we have a Gemara on the order of Tarot, which is based on anthologies that he prepared. Now, as you would expect, people, this aroused some opposition among rabbinical authorities, because they said, hey, here's somebody who's claiming he wrote a new Gemara. So it was required that he put on every page, this is not a Gemara, this is an anthology from previous sources, just to be sure that he wasn't claiming it was a newly discovered manuscript. Again, this is arcane. This is not a body of study that the average person gets involved in, but it's one that's extremely valuable for specialists. And this is what this Red Zener, just to digress, there is a reason to be concerned about forgeries. It's very interesting that around the same time as this came out, and that's probably why he had some trouble with this, there was a fellow, a Sephardic person, who claimed to have discovered a long-lost manuscript of the Jerusalem Talmud, which we don't have. But imagine, somebody who claimed to have discovered a new volume of Talmud, I mean, that would be a discovery of unimaginable magnitude. You know, that would be just short of saying, you know, we discovered the sixth book of the Torah or something. But just very, very important. And it turned out, and many of the great rabbis of the generation examined it, and they were convinced it was authentic. But eventually it turned out that they forged a Gemara. And of course, the reason he was eventually discovered was because he had to tell somebody, you know, such a monumental accomplishment. You know, I mean, that's how forgers often get caught, because there's a pride in their accomplishment, and they have to tell somebody. You know, the story about the rabbi who was a golf addict, you know, it's an old joke that he had to play golf every day. And even on Yom Kippur, so he goes to the golf course, this man did. I mean, on Yom Kippur, he has to play golf. God says, don't worry, I'll take care of him. And the rabbi gets a hole in one. So the angels come to God and they say, God, what are you doing? He has a hole in one. Yeah, who's he going to tell? That's the biggest punishment. No, that's the biggest one. So what happened in these forgeries were that the person eventually taught. And these
he must have been brilliant.
Imagine someone who had such a command of Talmud that he could write it in the style of the Talmud, in the language of the Talmud, in the concepts of it, to try to make it consistent with every teaching. And the area itself is a very difficult area of halakha. And he wrote commentaries on it as well. He faked the text, and then he wrote a commentary on the text. He wrote a commentary on his fake Gemara. He wrote his own commentary. Now,
insult to injury.
Now this happened around the early...
That was very common. The door is exactly...
Well, so, yeah, I don't want to get into that now, but you're correct. So some people, show them asserts at various points that that's a possibility of the Zohar itself, that Moshe Ben Leon may have written the Zohar and then he wrote commentaries on the Zohar. That may be the thing is this, that from the time of that forgery, all extant copies were basically destroyed and they're not available. I did see at the Ner Israel Library in Baltimore see a copy of this Jerusalem Talmud. There's a history. In fact, there is a history in Jewish literature generally of forgery. And forgery, at least in the early years, was not always regarded as a deceptive or dishonest practice. Sometimes forgery or attribution to somebody else was simply a way of legitimating the spread of ideas that you thought were legitimate. In other words, I won't call it a firm tradition, but at least there are a number of instances where people would write works and attribute them to someone else simply to gain acceptance for ideas that they genuinely believed were true. But this is kind of an extreme thing to write a Gemara. But that could be why, I have to check the dates, but that could be why the Radino Rebbe ran into trouble when he did, not a forgery, but he did a compilation of the Gemara on Targum. So I just want you to be aware of kind of the school of Ishbitz, which excels both in Kabbalah and in technical halachic analysis and in kind of science. It was a small school. There are, of course, surviving family members. Honestly. I mean, you could find a great-great-grandson here and there. You can find a few minyanim, etc., shtibbles and the like. But it is a school that I wouldn't say is a big school. It was never very big anyway. and certainly, as was true, unfortunately, for virtually all Hasidic groups, it's really the fingers of one and a half groups that flourished. I mean, there's Lubavitch, there's Ger, we'll talk about that, but I want to give you a session on that. But basically, before the war, there were countless small groups of Hasidim. These breakaways and breakaways from breakaways, etc. And you know, they basically for example, Radomsk was a local group of Hasidim. They had a part of Poland, but within that local group, they had 30 schools, 30 yeshivas, and numerous local or regional Hasidic groups that simply did not continue. After Poland was, above all, if we're focusing on Poland right now, we'll move back to Russia a little later on, but Poland was the greatest proliferation of the Hasidic groups, they say. Before World War I, between one-third and in some places over one-half of all Jews in different areas were Hasidic Jews, not Orthodox Jews, all Jews. Now, between the wars already, after World War I, there was a precipitous drop. What we had, unfortunately, was there was a great deal of assimilation that people of Hasidic families either became intermarried or they left Yiddishkeit, or they became socialists or communists or the like, or political or secular Zionists on that level. So the power of Hasidus did drop drastically, not only after the Holocaust, but between the wars, but also kind of a very significant low. Okay, so this was kind of the school of Ishvitz that you should be aware of. And again, I would suggest that now that you get a sense of the personalities, if you go back to Rebbe Zornberg and you can check her quotes of the Meishi Ruach, or she calls him the Ishvitzer. And this is the founder of the school. And keep in mind, he founded the school because he broke away from the Katzer Rebbe that Friday night. Did someone have a hand up? Okay. Let's go back to the Katz, and let's focus on the people who stayed. Right? The Ishvitzer broke away, but some people did stay. And the greatest disciple who remained with him was Rabbi Yitzchak Meir. Rattenberg was his last name. Rabbi Yitzchak Meir Rattenberg. Rim is an abbreviation. Rav Yitzchak Meir. And Rabbi Yitzchak Meir, in fact, is often called the Chidushei HaRim. Chidushei HaRim means the original thoughts of the Rim, because that was the name of the many books that he wrote. So we often refer to rabbis by the books that they authored.
Really?
Yes. That's a uniquely Jewish practice. Particularly of later authorities, for example, we refer, we refer to the author of the Shulchan Aruch, Rav Yosef Karo, as the Mechaber, the author. You know, so he's called either the Rim or Chidushei HaRim. And the greatness of Chidushei HaRim is that he was the one who founded a dynasty of his own, a dynasty that was located in Ger. Ger is a small city.
He stayed with the Kutzker.
Yes, he stayed with the Kutzker. He founded the dynasty. And when the Kutzker died, he founded the dynasty of Ger. Ger is a small little town around 30 miles from Warsaw. And Ger eventually became, as it were, the king of all Hasidic in Poland. There were many Hasidic groups in Poland, the largest. Ger had 1 million Hasidim. Not in the Chidushei HaRim's lifetime, obviously, but by World War I, there were 1 million Ger Hasidim in Poland. And even the smaller Hasidic courts had their own little orbits, but they kind of had allegiance to Ger. Ger was the in Polish Hasidut, and even today, in the aftermath of the Holocaust, seconds perhaps to Lubavitch. It's difficult how Lubavitch counts. The census is difficult because somebody once asked Lubavitch, how many Hasidim do you have? And they said, how many Jews are there in the world? You see, the reason is because Lubavitch, which is so actively involved in outreach, so if you go to the Chabad house, they might count you as a Lubavitch, because you're a Chabad house. So it's difficult to count, it's difficult to know, are Lubavitch counting Hasidim or Lubavitch counting people who deal. But with most Hasidic groups, which are not so actively involved in outreach, whether that's a good thing or not, I could tell if you're a Gerich Hasid or you're not a Gerich Hasid. So second perhaps to Lubavitch and Satmar, Ger is a very large group, particularly in Israel, and we'll talk about that too. But I want to go back to the founder of the Ger dynasty, and that is Rabbi Yitzchak Meir. Rabbi Yitzchak Meir remained with the Kutzker Rebbe. He loved the Kutzker Rebbe. He continued to learn from him, although he did adopt somewhat of... I'm giving you just some of the basic information. I just had it down here in seconds. Again, as is often the case, Rabbi Yitzchak Meir was a great prodigy as a child. I know this is a lot of these people were. He got married as a very young man. In fact, he was engaged at 9.
What?
But the marriage was, again, in other words, they contracted. This was not that uncommon. What often happened was this. This is not just because he did. This was a fairly common practice in Eastern Europe, that if there was a promising child prodigy who seemed to have the prospect of becoming a great scholar in Israel, so a wealthy person might get him for his daughter and promise to support him for 10 years or 20 years until he became a great rabbi and get a position. And as a result, formal documents of engagement, the called tanaim, were often drawn up at very young ages, even though the actual marriage didn't take place even that was relatively young, but 16 or 17. At that point, they would actually get married. Anyway, the Chedushin Harim did become engaged and married at a relatively young age. There's a famous story that his wife was once concerned at night studying the Torah, and it would adversely affect it. And he said, what's a genius? A genius is somebody who can accomplish in 1 hour what it takes other people 5 hours. Genius in sleeping. In 1 hour, and I kind of accomplish what it takes 6 hours. So you ought to trust me that I'm able to do it. Initially, the Chedushi Harim was still alive all the way back. This, you have to go back a few weeks. He was the old Magid of Kuznitz was still alive. Magid of Kuznitz. And for a while, the Chedushi Harim used to study with the son of the Magid of Kuznitz. Remember, Magid of Kuznitz was the prototype of the kind, gentle Hasidic Rebbe. And when the son of Magid of Kuznitz begged the Chedushi Harim to stay with him, a Rebbe that will kiss me, the place where he left the kind and gentle approach of the Magid of Kuznitz, and somehow people managed to find the place where they ought to be, and he did find his way to the Kutzker. And you see, obviously he was very attached to the Kutzker, because even after this revolution and everything else, he remained. Many years later, when the Kutzker was in his seclusion, the Chedushi Harim made a point of taking his young grandchildren to see the Kutzker, because he says it's important that one time in your life you see a true Jew and admiration for the Kutzker. Chedushi Harim once said